Today we're looking at Daniel chapter 8, and we're in the book of Daniel, but I can't cover in detail the whole chapter because there are 27 verses. Who's the idiot who gave us a whole chapter? Oh, that was me. Well, it's really a really brilliant idea to cover the whole chapter so we don't spend forever in the book of Daniel. As we look at this, we just have to remember that there is one, let's see if I can get verse that we need to remember, or one big key theme that we need to remember throughout. Namely, in Daniel 4:17, it says that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. It's important for us to recognize that the Most High rules. And we see that in what Tim was sharing with us earlier, the song. But we have to come to that, to grips with that. Now, I'm thinking that this needs to be prominently put in the both houses of Congress and the Oval Office. Especially that last verse, he sets over it the lowliest of men. And so as we look at this particular thing, we have to remember that because it not only applies in the houses of Congress, but it applies to you and I. For instance, we have bills that we have to get paid. Or maybe your car broke down, and maybe it was an expensive breakdown. Or maybe a tornado hit your house. And we might say, those are really bad circumstances, but remember, the Most High rules in the affairs of men. It's not a circumstance. It is something that God has brought into your life. He is in charge. It's not that he is simply saying, this is going to happen. Boy, I wish I could do something about it. But he actually allows it to occur in our life. Most High rules in the realm of mankind. And that's important for us to recognize. Now, today we're going to be looking at in chapter 8, about the ram and the goat. And it's about two of the kingdom 2 and 3. You know, we've talked about that in chapter 7 and chapter 2, about these four different kingdoms. And right now we are going to be focusing on kingdom number 2, the ram, Medo-Persia. And we're also going to be dealing with the third kingdom, Greece, which is the one-horned goat. All right, so those are the things that we are going to be focused on. Now, if we look at this in a timeline, you have these four kingdoms. And the first kingdom was a kingdom that Daniel was carried off into captivity under, Babylon. And that's Nebuchadnezzar and on. All right, and that was in the 500s. And it was only for about 70 years. Then comes the Medo-Persian Empire. That's one that we're going to, that's represented by the ram, and that's the one that we're going to be looking at, all right, or one of them. All right, and that's from the 500s, but it went for a couple hundred years to the 300s. Then the third kingdom comes along. This is Greece, and it's represented by the one-horned goat, and they were there from the 300s. They were the dominant power from the 300s, low 300s, to the 100s. And then, so those are the two kingdoms that we will be focusing on today. The fourth kingdom is Rome. We don't deal with that one today, but that's one of the four. And then we will also deal with the time of the end. Now, I've put in parentheses here the idea of the church. Well, the church is not particularly mentioned in any of these prophecies, but we've got 2,000 years of church history, and the end hasn't come yet, in case you haven't noticed. And so we are going to be looking at this. Now, as we look at this, it was the prophecies that are found in chapter 8 and all the other places are so accurate that people who were unbelievers that were expositors of the Bible, instead of saying this was written by Daniel in the 500s, are saying this was written by a pseudo-Daniel in the 100s, so that the stuff that is prophesied doesn't have to be prophecy. He's just looking back as if he were Daniel pretending to be Daniel so that he can add to his authority, his sense of authority. So, but what we're seeing with believers who are expositors is this was written by Daniel. This was written in the time of Daniel. And it was written about the God of Daniel. And it goes down to talking about a guy that is not mentioned by name, but it's Antiochus the Fourth. And he was in the 160s, that kind of that time frame. All right, and so we have to look at that and recognize that he's not a pseudo-Daniel. He is the real Daniel. And he is really receiving prophecy from God. Some of that prophecy was not fulfilled until in the 100s. And some of it hasn't been fulfilled yet, as we will see. But these prophecies begin with the age of Cyrus. Cyrus was the first great king of Persia, who will come in a dozen years or so after this prophecy is made. All right, so this is coming toward the end of the Babylonians, and it's coming to that time, that frame. So then the kingdom itself, after Cyrus the First comes, that kingdom will outlast him by about 200 years, down to the time of Cyrus the Third, who will be the last king before the Greeks come in and take over. All right, so that gives you a little bit of an overview of this. Now, we know a lot about this period, not just from the Bible, but also from the father of history, Herodotus, who lived in the early 400s. And so he comes not too long after this. And when I started out, I thought, well, there's a lot of good stories in Herodotus. For instance, he talks about how Cyrus's grandfather wanted to put him to death because of a dream that he had. And I wish I had time to tell you about that story, because it's a really good one, but I don't. And then there's also the idea that Cyrus was raised by a she-wolf or a dog. And that's somewhat true, but not really. But it is somewhat. I wish I had time to tell you about it, but I don't. Then we could also go on to talk about Croesus, wealthy King Croesus of Lydia, who lived about that time. And he was so concerned about Cyrus conquering him that he sent some envoys to the New York Times. I mean the oracle at Delphi. And so they went to the oracle at Delphi, where the prophetess sits on this tripod over these emissions that come out of the earth. And once she's gone completely bonkers, she begins to give these prophecies, and they're kind of double-edged prophecies so that no matter how they turn out, they're always right. So that, for instance, it says to Croesus, to his envoys, it says, okay, if you go forth against Cyrus, you'll destroy a great army. And they did, their own. So that's the kind of the prophecies that were going on at the time. Now, I could also talk about Cyrus and how he became a mule, if I had time to do that, but I don't. And there's an interesting story that Herodotus tells also about how Cyrus conquered the city of Croesus, Lydia, that he conquered it because one soldier lost his helmet. It's a really interesting story, and I wish I had time to tell it, but I don't. However, on the back in the lobby there, I have a sheet of paper that has different links that you can go to find the rest of the stories by Herodotus. So if you're curious, go there, because I'm not going to cover any more of it than I have. All right, but now, back to the issue of the two-horned ram, that's Medo-Persia, and the one-horned goat, that's Greece. This is the basic storyline, and it's really pretty straightforward. You have this two-horned ram, that's Medo-Persia, who conquers to the north and the south and the east. And they are dominant in that area. And then out of the west, and remember, this was in the 500s, and it doesn't happen until the 300s. But out of the west comes this one-horned goat, and that one horn is Alexander the Great. And the goat is Greece. And they come and tramples down the two-horned ram. All right, so that's a, whoops. Let's get here. All right. And so he comes down and he tramples down the ram. Now, this is all prophetic. Here's Daniel living in the 500s. And God is giving him prophecy that pertains to the 300s, to the low 300s. And so this is what's going to happen in the future. But it also goes on and talks about this little horn. Now, the horn, who's not mentioned by name, but it's Alexander the Great. And he comes in and he conquers this area. And then shortly after that, the horn breaks and it comes up, four horns come up. Well, Alexander the Great died when he was only 33 years old. And so on his deathbed, people said, well, who's going to take your place? He said, whoever can. And so basically you end up with his four primary generals end up as the rulers in these different areas. And the ruler to the north of Israel is later, six generations later, is going to produce what's called the little horn, because it's in the passage. It talks about four horns coming forth, and then a little horn comes out of the existing horns. All right, and so that's verses 9 through 14 where it explains about it. And it talks about Antiochus the Fourth. It doesn't mention his name, but that's who it's talking about. This is all presented in verses 1 through 14. Now, I say that this is pretty straightforward because it is explained in verse 15 through 22, other than doesn't give you the name Alexander the Great or Antiochus the Fourth. But he conquered and then he died. And you have these four that come up. In fact, I'll present that. All right, you can't really read this, who these are, but these are, you see the goat with the four horns, and then the little horn, Antiochus the Fourth, who comes out of one of the horns, the horn to the north. And then you have a bust of Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, who, by the way, was known by, among the Jews. He didn't get along very well with the Jews. He conquered them, killed 40,000 in one sitting. And so they called him Epimenes, which means madman. But he called himself Epiphanes, meaning an epiphany of God, a showing forth of God. So that was the little horn, Antiochus the Fourth. All right, now looking at Daniel 8, verses 23 through 25. In the latter period of their rule, that is the four kings, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise. That is Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth. And he will be arrogant, insolent, and skilled in intrigue. That's really true. He was not the true heir to the throne, but he managed to take it over anyway. And he will, his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. It's God who put him in place. And it's important for us to recognize that God not only puts the good kings in place, he also puts the bad kings, like Antiochus, in place. And we have to understand that. Otherwise, we're not going to think that God is in charge. We're going to think, well, boy, if God could only do something. And so we tend to think of him as a Santa Claus, only he does real nice things. And yet, it is by God that, not by his own power, that he became king. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. All right. Well, he had a special hating for Israel, which is kind of on the frontier of his kingdom. And he wanted to make them conform. So he ends up killing a whole bunch of them. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart. And he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. That's because he died of a disease. There was some kind of disease that was so painful, but he continued to try to press on in conquest. And so he had his chariot going very fast, but because of the pain and that sort of thing, he fell out of the chariot, and shortly after that he died. In other words, he died without human cause. It wasn't a flying arrow or any such thing as that. And then it talks about him magnifying himself in his own heart. There's a general agreement that this passage is talking about Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, a later king of the North Kingdom, about six generations after the first king took over from Alexander. And he fulfilled, and that Antiochus fulfilled all of the things that are described here, or did he? Well, we'll look at that in a minute. His insolence and intrigue, the destruction he did to most of Egypt in a war that he had there, and he killed 40,000 in the Holy Land, 40,000 Jews, in order to take over the Holy Land. His shrewdness and deceit, and his magnifying of himself. And verse 25 says, and he will magnify himself in his heart. He had a coin made with his head on it. And on the backside, it says, Theos Epiphanu. In other words, I'm a manifestation of God. So talk about magnifying himself. He took a title that belongs to the Prince of Princes, and he took it for himself. So talk about magnifying himself. And so what we're looking at here is something that was fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes long before Jesus came. But that's not all. This is where we come up with the idea of double fulfillment. That we have Antiochus Epiphanes, but we also have a picture here of Antichrist. By the way, notice that the Antichrist in this picture looks somewhat like Christ. That's because when we think of anti, we think of someone who opposes Christ. But the Greek term actually means someone who substitute for Christ. When Antichrist comes, he will not only be opposing the true Christ, but he will also appear to be a savior. Now, that's the picture that will come. So there's a double fulfillment here in this passage, so that we can read this passage as an unbelieving expositor might and say, oh, this was all fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes in his day in the 160s. But what we see is that there is a double fulfillment. Let me give you an example of a double fulfillment. You're all familiar with Isaiah 7:14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. And you think, wow, that's a great prophecy. And it is. But the word for virgin there in Hebrew is the word Alma, which can mean a virgin or it can mean just a young maiden, you know, of childbearing age. And so the word there is Alma, and it can mean either way. And in fact, in the prophecy at that point, the immediate fulfillment of it, remember I talked about double fulfillment? The immediate fulfillment is Isaiah is going to have a son through his wife. It's not going to be a virgin birth, but the young maiden is going to bear a son. Okay, so that's what's going on in the context. All right, but in the New Testament, we see that this is prominently used, like in Matthew 1:23, where it uses the Greek word parthenos. Now, you've heard of the Parthenon in Athens, Greece, and it's a temple that's dedicated to Athena, the virgin goddess. Okay, and so Parthenos means particularly virgin, the idea of virgin. And this is what we find in the New Testament. Aha, in Matthew 1:23, it's Jesus is going to be born of a virgin birth. And in Matthew 1:23, you actually have a situation here in which Joseph says, okay, I'm going to keep her that way, you know, even after we're married, until she has this child. All right, and so you see a double fulfillment. The fulfillment in the time of Isaiah is through the prophet Isaiah and his wife. The fulfillment long term, as the New Testament recognizes, is through Jesus born of a virgin. All right, and so that's an important thing for us to recognize, that Isaiah 7:14 is in fact a recognition of the whole idea of double fulfillment. All right, now let's see how this applies in the book of Daniel in chapter 8. All right, now back in Daniel 8, in verse 17, it says, understand that the vision that's being portrayed here pertains to the time of the end. And verse 19, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So, what does that mean? The end of what? Well, Antiochus died in 164 BC, so as long before the end, even if you counted the end as being the first coming of Christ. He comes 164 years after. So, it is the end of Antiochus, but at the same time, it's not the end of anything of biblical significance. And so, whatever the case may be, there's a double fulfillment here, and that's what this is hinting at. Is this pertains to the time of the end? Well, what end? What is this end? And so we're going to look at this, and let me read Daniel chapter 8, verses 24 through 26. Now, I haven't written it out on the screen, but some of you probably have a Bible. And so we're going to look at 24 through 26. It's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and the one who had come, the Antichrist, at the end time. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. And he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart. And he will destroy many while they are at their ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. All right, so when we look at this particular passage, then let's also look at Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Brett's passage next week. But I come first, so nanny, nanny, boo-boo. And so any questions that you have, then I'm sure he can answer those questions next week. All right, so let's look at the numbers here. All right, so Michaela and Sarah, I want you to pay close attention because I'm going to have you do some addition in a little while. All right. Now, it starts out by saying 70 weeks. Now, the word for weeks is actually seven. Okay, and it is translated week, but it can be also just translated seven. So then the question is 70 weeks or 70 years? But in any case, have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end to sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness. Now, that could all be fulfilled in the first coming of Jesus. But then he goes on to seal up vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy place, which didn't happen. Notice then the promise that these 70 weeks will not only be for atonement from sin, but will be accomplished in the death of Christ, which will be accomplished in the death of Christ, but also the sealing up of prophecy, which so most certainly has not happened yet. Okay, so verse 25. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild the Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince has come will be 7 weeks, or again, seven sevens, and 62 weeks. All right, so Michaela, you and Sarah, 7 weeks and 62 weeks. I'm going to ask you what that adds up to in a minute. All right. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. So if you add 62 and 7, you come up with, Michaela, 69, she says, with certain trepidation. Is that right, Sarah? Okay, and Sarah is quite confident that's correct. And it is correct. All right, so on the right-hand column, then you have 7 plus 62 is 69 weeks. But if we take that as weeks of years, as you do in prophecy, 69 weeks or 483 weeks of years. So 483 years after the decree to go to rebuild Jerusalem. All right, and that comes right down to the very week that Jesus comes into Jerusalem on the donkey and then is killed, the end of that week. But we're already told that they're given 70 weeks. So the question is, what happened to that extra week? All right, so that extra week, that is extra 7 or extra 7 years, is what we would call the tribulation, and it hasn't happened yet. All right, so you have this 483 years that leads to the time of Christ's first coming. And then we have a whole week of 7 years, week of years, 7 years that we haven't accounted for. But in verse 27, it goes on to talk about those years. So this just continue in the context. This is in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. All right, so that's the 1 week. All right, notice that that 1 week is made up of a couple of different parts. You have a promise of 7 years of peace, but in the middle of that, then after 3.5 years, then you have one who brings in the abomination, will come one who makes desolate. Now, Jesus referred to this very thing in Matthew 24, which is a passage that deals with prophecy. In Matthew 24:15, he talks of the abomination of desolation. It's that directly related to Daniel. He mentions Daniel in the passage. All right, so that's an important thing to recognize, because in that Matthew 24 passage, it is yet future to his own time, to Jesus' first coming. All right, so when we talk about 7 years of tribulation, this is the passage that we go to. All right, it's a time, the first 3.5 years are a time of peace. And the last is a time of great struggle. But in between, then you have that is yet future. So what I'm saying is this, that when you look at this passage, then what you're seeing is a double fulfillment. You see that Antiochus IV has been the one, the focal point up to this point. But in then verse 27, it actually switches to the end time and talks about the abomination of desolation. And Jesus is telling us in Matthew 24 that that hasn't happened yet. So that's one of the things that we look forward to, or don't look forward to, but it's in the future. And that is the 7 years of tribulation, and the last 3.5 years of that are usually called the Great Tribulation. And the middle point is the abomination of desolation. So that's why I say that, you know, if you're an unbeliever, then you would say, oh, that was all fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes, but verse 27 has never been fulfilled. And Jesus recognizes it hasn't been fulfilled. All right, and so that's yet future. So you have this double fulfillment. In other words, the Antichrist who's coming at the end will be somewhat like Antiochus Epiphanes who came in the 160s B.C. All right, so when we study him, we not only learn something about history for us, it was prophecy for Daniel because he lived in the 500s, and this is in the 160s. Well, 160 B.C. is before our time. Even Garland doesn't date back that far. But at the recognition then that that was history, but then it's also a prophecy. It's a looking forward to one who is like Antiochus Epiphanes, but he will be the Antichrist or the beast, as he's called in the New Testament. All right, so let's look at the conclusion of this. What are we to gain from it? Well, I think it's interesting to study prophecy. In fact, it was such a dominant thing in the 1970s that most of us who lived through that period said, we didn't want to hear any more about prophecy, prophecy, prophecy. Because you could go to a prophecy conference every weekend, and they would tell you who exactly was the Antichrist. But they were never right. And so we have to look at this as something that is yet future to us. But what does that mean for us? Because whatever we might say about the 7 years of tribulation, it isn't pleasant. And so there are people that are going through their own tribulation. We're not in the 7 years of tribulation, I don't think. But, you know, people in China and the Uyghurs and people like that are going through a lot of tribulation. But here is the response of Daniel's friends when they are threatened with the fiery furnace. In chapter 3, the fiery furnace chapter, verses 17 and 18. If it be so, they are saying to Nebuchadnezzar, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Now, I don't know what they had in mind. They might have thought, well, one way or the other, he's going to deliver us out of your hand, because if we're burned up, we're in God's hands. We're no longer in your hands. So they're not certain of how this is going to turn out, but they trust that God is the one that is in charge. Verse 18, but even if he does not save us, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. That's the challenge to us, is that in this very secular time that's becoming more secular every year, we have to take the stand. Do we believe in God? Do we trust in God that he is the Most High who rules in the affairs of men? Or are we going to let that slide, you know, in order to be safe? Are we going to conform to the world, which hates Jesus and will continue to hate him more and more and more? So we need to remember that even if our God doesn't save us, even if we're burned up to ashes, we will not worship your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. We need to have that same kind of courage as men and women of faith, in case it comes to that. But we have to remember that the God of heaven rules in the affairs of men. Nothing happens to you or to me that isn't provided for and taken care of by understanding that God rules in the affairs of men. He rules in your life, even if bad stuff is happening. It's important for us to recognize that. Let me pray before we have our closing hymn. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Thank you for your goodness and mercy to us in every way. And Lord, strengthen us and help us to be like Daniel's companions and like Daniel himself. Not in the sense of receiving his prophecies, that's up to you, but in the sense of taking a stand for you, even in front of the fiery furnace. Thank you, Lord, for your goodness to us. Amen. Tim?
Is this on? Can you hear this? Well, we're going to do it anyway. So the last song is the only way I really know, right? I can think of how to stand, right? In something like that, in anything, is to not try really hard to stand, but to just try really hard to hold on to Jesus. Because that's where the strength comes from anyway. Right? That's where the hope is. So the last song we're going to sing is Give Me Jesus. In the morning when I rise, in the morning when I rise, in the morning when I rise, give me Jesus, give me Jesus, give me Jesus. 'Cause you can have all this world, just give me Jesus. When I am alone, oh, when I am alone, whoa, when I am alone, give me Jesus, give me Jesus, give me Jesus. You can have all this world, just give me Jesus. When I come to die, oh, when I come to die, oh, when I come to die, give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. 'Cause you can have all this world. Just give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. 'Cause you can have all this world. You can have all this world. You can have all this world. Just give me Jesus.